Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Thanks for choosing Premier Christian Radio. I'm Justin Brierley with you here on Unbelievable through till 4 o'clock this afternoon. My thanks to Megan for Premier's I Choose. And don't forget Dave and B here from 4 o'clock with Hip Rock UK. Well, today on the program, I'd like to introduce you to a top US apologist.
You're unbelievable.
His name, of course, is Josh McDowell, and he's going to be in conversation with Kieran O'Pronte. Now, this is a rerun of a show from about a year and a half ago. I've got a good excuse. My wife recently gave birth, and so there's been a slight blockage in being able to get the shows together. But it's a fantastic program, and we're going to be hearing their exchange on the subject of whether Jesus really was God. That's what a lot of the conversation is going to be about. So do stay tuned here on Unbelievable. And we're going to be hearing from Josh McDowell, as I say, a top US apologist. He's been a defender of the faith for many, many years, famed for books such as Evidence That Demands a Verdict. So it's a real pleasure to be able to hear him on the program today. But for this first part of the program, we're just going to look at your responses for the moment to the last few weeks. I've just had so many emails, voicemail messages. I don't know what's been happening on the program recently, but just so many topics that seem to have got you interested recently. Let's first of all start with just a couple more responses to those programs where we were joined by John W. Loftus, the Christian who became an atheist. He was on the line to us from the States. In particular, his deconversion was a lot of what those shows were about. They're online now at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Fascinating stuff. Lots of people have been getting in touch with me since they went out. Here's another caller who only recently got wind of the programs.
Oh, hello. It's Lynette Jennings. I was rather sort of late for John Loftus's program. I listened very attentively, and I was actually very saddened by his comment that he had fallen and had an affair, and he said people rejected him, and that was a sad thing. But I also would like to comment. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I've studied psychology, and the Pavlov, most people know of Pavlov's experiment with ringing a bell to get a dog to eat. But there's another part of that experiment, or which actually happened by accident, and that is that those kennels were flooded and the dogs had to be pulled out underwater. And most of them panicked. And it was noted that once they got over the panic and were safe, they turned against the kennel attendants that they'd previously liked and liked the ones they hadn't liked. And then subsequently, he then put them through more stress, and they reverted to type. They went back to what they'd been before the flood and the panic associated with that. And I was wanting to apply it to John Loftus, whether perhaps the reason he turned so much against Christianity was because of the very severe distress he suffered by that rejection. And whether, you know, that sort of opens the door that if he has some other serious rejection somewhere, he may well come back to faith.
Thank you very much, Lynette, for your call. Quick email as well coming from Norman Hansen. He's been a guest on this program. He's an atheist. You say about the program with John Loftus here, Norman. I'd like to commend Peter for not jumping into the usual accusation that John's affair caused his atheism or that he was not a real Christian in the first place. My own deconversion to atheism has parallels with John in that creationism forced me to rethink my beliefs. But in my case, there was no affair or other crisis that preceded this to sensitise me to an alternative idea. I do have one issue I'd like to raise in Peter's apologetics. The Kalam argument begs more questions than it can ever answer and still does not answer the question of why there is something rather than nothing. Just to break away from your email here, Norman, the Kalam argument, if you're wondering, is the argument that God exists because there has to be a cause, if you like, for the world, the universe, to exist itself. You go on to say, this argument is like a grown-up version of explaining to a child how Santa Claus can get down the chimney of a house without a chimney. When confronted with the proof that the Santa hypothesis is inconsistent with reality, the adult doesn't want to break the magic of Christmas for the child, so they think of ever more convoluted and implausible mechanisms to substitute for the chimney. And you essentially are saying that God simply doesn't make sense if you're trying to put him as the first cause of the universe, because there's no content there. Thank you for your email, Norman. Also had one in from Sam Nico on that program with John. You said that to the second program, you felt John's, contribution was disappointing, where he was talking about different people in different places of the earth will be raised in different religions. To begin with, you say, to say we would be Hindus if we were raised in a country of that religion is like saying that we would be raised speaking French in a French-speaking country. It's stating the obvious and tells us nothing about why people are religious, suggesting we are all clones with no minds of our own. And you say that John needs to take off his science glasses, whereby only things that have all the basis of scientific evidence will get passed. Thank you for all your responses to those programmes. I think we're going to have to draw a line under that now, just because we've had so much response and probably we need to focus on other things. Let's look at the programme of a couple of weeks ago. Lots of you wanted to get in contact after our philosophical discussions with Peter Cave, our philosophical atheist, and Peter S. Williams, our Christian philosopher. Let's hear some of your responses by telephone to that subject that we were talking about for some time, the problem of evil and a good God.
Hello, my name is Asher. I've just been listening to the programme with the two Peters on it. The point I would like to raise about there being a lot of suffering in the world and, good God and bad God and all that, is that I do believe in a good God, and I believe that God has created man and given man free will and a free spirit to make their decision and their choices. And I think the reason why there's so much evil in the world is because man is inherently destructive, and because of sin has created a lot of sin in the world, a lot of destruction in the world, a lot of hurt in the world, and that's why there is a lot of suffering. It doesn't discount the fact that there is a God. And the question I would like to put to Peter, the atheist, is what are you going to do? What are you doing about the suffering in the world? What are you doing to reduce the suffering in the world? Your moral drive, how does that direct you in sort of reducing the suffering in the world? That's a question I would like to put to Peter A. Okay, thank you. Bye bye.
Hello, this is Barry from Liverpool. I'm just listening to Unbelievable on the 19th of the 4th, whether there's a God or there isn't a God, about saying the suffering. I'm a Christian. A lot of the suffering around the world is man-made. It's not God-made. God gave us the choice between right and wrong. Even our Lord suffered through the hands of evil men. So at the end of the day, it's up to us whether we do right or do wrong. Thank you.
Oh, hi. My name is Peter Johnson. I've been listening to the programme about, I think there must be an atheist chap on there, and they're talking about the moral law. And what I don't understand from the point of view that you put across was the fact that if one does believe in absolute moral law, there has to be a reason for doing so. Why does he believe in absolute moral law if it's not based on a personal lawgiver? Then how can he actually say that, say, Nazi morality or communist morality or any one of the other countless philosophies that exist on the planet are right or wrong? Surely if you believe that a moral law doesn't come from a person, there's no way that you can say that it actually has a call on your life to obey it. It's only if it comes from a person. I'm sure the other guy actually said the same thing.
Thank you for your responses. Reginald emailed as well to say, "Come on, Mr. Brierley, grow up and stop behaving like a giggly schoolgirl who seems to be in awe of Mr. Cave. Where are your grown-up and mature Christians? Your Christian guest at least takes things seriously, whereas your atheist appears to belittle and make a joke out of theistic belief." Thank you, Reginald. Oh, I stand, you know, admonished. I didn't realise I was acting like a giggly schoolgirl in the presence of our atheist guest. But I'm sure anyone listening to that programme would recognise that he obviously had a sort of jokey style. And, you know, I don't think there's any harm in you know, joining in the joke. Not that I'm, you know, in any way trying to downplay the seriousness of the topic that we were talking about. But yes, lots of responses, as I say, to that programme. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Again, if you want to listen to that programme of 2 weeks ago. Here's Peter Harris in Dartford. He says, "I'd like to email to thank you for the quality of that unbelievable programme. The best programme by far on Premier." Well, thank you very much, Dartford. Apart from across the pond, you say. "So the debate today was of a high quality. I think, however, that Peter Cave won the debate. I don't think Peter Williams' undergraduate level of philosophy could match the loose rationality of Peter Cave. With regards to debates on very difficult issues for Christians, such as the problem of evil, it's important for Premier to find a Christian philosopher who has a better grasp of the problem." You suggest, for instance, Alvin Plantinga, who I think is an American philosopher. Thank you very much for listening, Peter. And you say you're pleased that Unbelievable has survived its critics, who would rather ignore the fact that God also gave them brains and regard their religion as solely a matter of the heart. Rosny says, "It's the first time I've listened to your programme Unbelievable. Wow. The only way we will believe the Bible is to have faith. I can see that this atheist Peter has no faith. Satan has really blinded the eyes and mind of man. I believe God, Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit is real. Equally, Satan's and the demons." So you're essentially putting his philosophical doubts down to the influence, you know, of Satan, which is obviously a very different approach to Peter, whose email we read just previous to yours, Rosny. Let's just look at a couple more now. Anna Pregner felt that Peter Williams, our Christian, should have argued more from the Bible in that programme. And you were emailing in from Albania there, where you say we need to be clear about what we believe. Also, Sam Nico again says the programme that was based on paradoxes and absurdities of faith. Well, he says a famous atheist following the tsunami disaster stated that this would test the faith of believers in a good God. He trotted out the usual argument about a good God and the terrible events in the world that argued against it. So I imagine this scenario, that the tsunami never happened, but that the atheist on board a submarine sees a gigantic supernatural safety pin holding tectonic plates together, preventing a movement that could cause a tsunami. Well, what would be the response? It would not be evidence of God's goodness, far from it. It would be evidence of interference, and his declaration to God would be to leave us to solve our own problems. It would be regarded as an affront to his intelligence or the collective power of man to deal with their own problems. This is the true basis of atheism, and not the superficial lack of evidence that was Peter's main argument, says Sam Nico. Finally, on the emails on this programme, Peter Provor says, "So another atheist wants to tell us about the lack of evidence, etc. It's getting very repetitive and tiresome, since a truly spiritual person would agree that there is no evidence for their faith, whose roots run much deeper than that. The issues of good and evil are not new either, and were and are more ably discussed in the book of Job, and with much more openness. John, in the previous week, at least had the honesty to admit to scientific atheism as a default position. And of course, that is a position of total security, since it filters out anything unevidenced, which means it has nothing to say about faith and religion." But with Peter this week, there was something slightly unsavoury. He didn't engage in debate and took every opportunity to try to sell his book, shamelessly asking Christians to express their charity in action and buy it, or hoping that your broadcast might paint him as the bad guy and generate a fatwa that would also simulate sales. Atheism, it seems, likes to disguise its own self-interest and is not as objective as it would like us believe. The more charitable Christian perspective would never dream of trying to evangelise on this basis, while to the atheist, everything is a hoarding, a selling space, even the camp of its perceived enemy. Well, thank you very much, Peter, for those emails. We're going to look at some more of your responses to last week's programme on the resurrection, that debate that was had between evangelist Tony Costa and sceptic Ken Humphreys. Before we get to that, time to catch up with the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity. And today we've got the thoughts of Jason Gardner being read by Ian Turner, his thoughts on the latest big reality TV show.
Connecting with culture.
I sacked Simon Smith. Yep, I gave last week's hapless contestant on The Apprentice his marching orders. Okay, the TV evidence is that it was the lovable epitome of all things shrewd and opportunistic Sir Alan Sugar who fired him. But at least I was there to back up his decision. As part of the studio audience for The Apprentice, You're Fired, the follow-up show that interviews each week's victim, I got to wave my red card at Simon when the mob was asked how we'd have handled him. In Sir Alan's opinion, the ex-army man, now a satellite engineer, was amiable and industrious, but simply out of his depth as a leader and the project had been assigned. I heartily agreed, and though I have no proven business acumen myself, I stand by my TV-ordained right to make flash judgments based on the slightest of slanted evidence. Got me thinking, though. How, when it came to the biggest job on earth, building the kingdom of God, did Simon Peter get hired to provide the foundation? Sure, he was bolshy, spoke his mind, and was proactive when it came to exercising faith, but was he the best choice? Could Jesus have chosen only Peter for that position? As for the rest of the apostles, did they exhibit qualities not found in other fishermen, tax collectors, and would-be insurgents? And here's where I have a problem with the Great Commission. Jesus seemed to be telling the 11, "My family business has an aggressive, expansive directive. Not only are you hired, I want you to get out there and hire anyone you come across and train them to hire anyone they come across so that they, well, you get the idea. What kind of discernment is that? What kind of business seems fit to hire anyone and everyone and train them to train others regardless of experience? It seems Jesus had this intention right from the start. Right at the outset, his job offer came with a career development package. Come, follow me, he said, and I will make you fishers of men. For Peter and Andrew, it was about swapping one family business for another. They chose wisely, and so did Jesus. Which still leaves me wondering, what is it about you and about me that makes God take one look at us and say, you're hired?
That was Connecting with Culture, brought to you by the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity.
Thoughts there of Jason Gardner being read by Ian Turner. Let's just quickly brief you what's happening on the programme today. We are going to be hearing shortly from two people. One of them is a famed US apologist. Josh McDowell is on the programme today. We're rerunning an episode from about a year and a half ago where he met Kieran O'Pronte and they had a fascinating discussion, dialogue. Kieran, an atheist, but certainly interested in the Christian faith, and Kieran's questions being answered by Josh McDowell on the programme today. The tough questions that Kieran puts to him. How can we know that Jesus was God? That sort of thing is what we're looking at today. So do stay tuned for that coming up very shortly. Just time, though, to give a bit of more response to last week's programme on the resurrection, where apologist Tony Costa went head-to-head with Ken Humphreys, who is an extreme sceptic to the point where he doesn't even believe Jesus existed, let alone rose from the dead. So let's hear some of your responses initially to that programme.
Hello, my name is Osei, and then I was just listening to Unbelievable, and I wanted Ken, I think he's the atheist, to clarify something for me, because it's easy for people to give vague statements to throw something off course. He does not believe that Jesus was the one who was crucified, and as such he is not giving us anything to indicate who was crucified then, and then where was he buried, and where is the tomb of that person, and where is the remains of that person. I want him to answer that question for us. We accept that he's in contention of the fact that we don't know if Jesus Christ was the one who was crucified, but he should be able to supply us who was then crucified, and as such, where was he buried, and where is the tomb. That's my question, in a way.
This is John Hampshire speaking. ringing from West Yorkshire. I'd just like to say I'm not a scholar, but I know that my Lord is alive, and I will meet him one day when he comes for us. And I would just like to say how I know he's alive when I pray to him and get answers from him. That's how I know he's alive. And I feel sorry for the man who doesn't believe in his resurrection. It says in John 3:16, that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. And if that man doesn't believe in our Lord Jesus Christ has risen, he's going to perish. That's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Hello, I'm just listening to the program at the moment, and there's an unbelieving man talking about the gospel. And why he doesn't seem to know, or no one's pointed out to him, that the Holy Spirit descended on the apostles and helped them to remember everything that Jesus had happened between them, him and them and Jesus. And I don't know why talking to someone like that has any point, as he's not going to believe. And that's the whole thing. We haven't seen Jesus, but we believe, because we believe. It's down to fate. And it's nobody's pointed out to this man. Well, I suppose he wouldn't believe it anyway, but there you are. Thank you. Bye.
Well, thank you for all those responses. More phone calls coming up in a moment in response to this. Here's some of what you emailed me with, though. Milton Grant emailed to say, my faith in the resurrection of Jesus is strengthened by his illustration of the corn of wheat in John 12:24. This to me is a very powerful lesson from nature, of which he is the creator, and he likens it to his death, which must happen if many are to have life, like the corn of wheat by his resurrection. I think that's the saying where unless a seed falls into the ground and dies, it can't resurrect, if you like, and bring forth new life. Stephen Carr is an atheist. He says, my resurrection debate at resurrectiondebate.blogspot.com is drawing to a close. Did Tony, your apologist, engage in circular reasoning? He believes a resurrection is possible because there is a God. To avoid circular reasoning, he now has to avoid saying that he believes there is a God because there was a resurrection. So if the resurrection does not show there is a God, because that would be circular reasoning, what evidential value does it have? Okay, thanks, Stephen. Sure, I completely followed that, but thank you for your input as well. And finally, the Jesus Heals Ask team emailed me to say, we believe in the resurrection of Jesus and his ascension because there is power in the name of Jesus. There would not be that power in Jesus' name if he did not resurrect and ascend. It is his resurrection that gives his continued authority over evil. It is this continued power and authority that won him his current role as spiritual saviour and spiritual king of the earth. Well, of course, that's true from those who believe it, from that perspective. But of course, we ask the questions on this show, or we allow people to ask questions who aren't coming from a Christian perspective. And that's what we're going to be doing as the programme proceeds and we meet Kieran O'Pronti, our atheist guest on the programme today, our sceptic. And he's going to be in dialogue with Josh McDowell from the US as they talk about some of the tough questions about Christianity. That's coming shortly. Just a few more of your responses on the phones now, particularly in regard to the whole question of how much evidence do we need to believe in Jesus' death and resurrection? Because Ken Humphreys, our atheist last week, well, according to these callers, say he was just asking too much.
This is David Wilkins speaking, and I am a student at Roehampton University. My point is this. I'm not too interested in academic debates, but history is the love of my life. My question is this. Why are you denying the sources that are there? Is it just because you don't like them? Or because you think unless there are original sources, what's being said must be false. As a historian, I'm here to say that if I'm given something which agrees in every detail exactly, and where everything says exactly the same thing, and they were from about five different people, I would be convinced somebody had been fiddling around. But if I receive sources where there are variations, there are differences, but they more or less say the same thing, I will be much more convinced. And finally, to argue that the fact that Mark is used in Matt's gospel, in Matthew's gospel and in Luke's gospel, showed that it's fabrication, actually shows to me that what the gospel writers have done is done what any writer, journalist or historian does do, and that's look at the evidence and use part of the other sources which they have for their work. If it was 100% original, it would suggest to me they were making something up. That's all I've got to say, and I hope you like my comment. Bye!
Justin, I was listening to your program this afternoon. My name is Regina. I wonder if your 80s guest, Ken, needs Jesus' birth certificate and death certificate for him to believe anything at all, because of that, I think there is enough historical evidence. Thank you.
Hello, Justin. My name is John, and I thought I'd just leave this comment. A Christian is always more interested in the words in their books, their holy books, and what they mean than they are in the provenance of the paper it's written on. Atheists, on the other hand, spend their time carbon dating, checking credentials, and that really they've got no interest in the meaning of the words. Consequently, the best they ever say is that possibly they might be genuine, but they can throw no light at all on the meaning. No surprises there, then. So they fight against it from what looks like a position of strength, always calling out for where's your evidence, knowing full well that it's never going to be forthcoming, because people who are religious found their faith upon a completely different order of experience, which has got nothing at all to do with what's provable. Besides, all religions connect themselves to the real world through their experience of it. Like resurrection, for instance, through a different way of seeing. Muslims call it similitudes, so do Hindus. But Christians often fail to see that Christ often speaks with those sorts of correspondences. For instance, a seed must fall to the ground and die before it springs up and brings forth new life, something he said in John. Atheists, I said, didn't give this any more thought than maybe calling it poetry. But every faith knows that it points towards something much deeper, and which culminates in resurrection itself. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, John, for that response. Thank you for everyone who's contacted, and we'll be giving out the details if you'd like to get in contact a little bit later on in the programme. Do remember, if you want to look on the webpage to hear these programmes that we've been hearing the responses to in this section of the programme, do go online, premier.org.uk/...
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
Unbelievable. And tell your friends.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And welcome along to this special edition of the programme. And joining us in the studio today is author Josh McDowell. Josh, a well-known name in the evangelical Christian world, an international ministry that encompasses youth work, leadership, but probably best known for his work in the area of Christian apologetics. That is, the whole area of defending the Christian faith. Perhaps best known for Evidence That Demands a Verdict. That was a best-selling book of Josh's that he believes provides conclusive proof that Jesus did rise from the
dead. And he's authored a number of other books as well. And we're going to be looking at some of the claims in a book of Josh's that, well, goes back a few years now, but it's called Answers to Tough Questions About the Christian Faith. And we're going to be seeing about some of those tough questions as Kieran O'Pronte joins us. He is not a Christian, lives in Ireland, but is a listener of Premier Radio. He's been interested in some of the things we've done over the years. And Kieran has some of his own questions about the Christian faith. We're going to see what comes out of our discussion today. It should be an interesting programme. Do hope you can stay with us. Well, thank you both gentlemen for being able to be with us here in the studio. Kieran, of course, on the line from Ireland. And, well, let's kick things off and maybe just get a bit of background to both of you gentlemen. First of all, Kieran, for those who perhaps haven't come across you before, you did contribute to one programme a while back. But what's your background as far as faith goes, Kieran?
Well, having been brought up a Catholic, but perhaps in an environment which was... allowing questioning all the time, and even within the Catholic Church was quite good at allowing questioning, you know, and schooling and things like that. But eventually came to the idea that this belief which I felt I had was not a belief, it was sort of more of a cultural thing which I'd been brought up in, and that tough questions had to be asked, and probably an idea of being truthful to what you see around you and what you actually think. And the idea of thinking rather than taking things on trust, to me, is actually very important. It's not a rejection of Christianity, but it's the idea that it would be very strange to accept something on trust if you're not sure that this should be, maybe, perhaps.
So from a relatively early age, you felt that what you were being fed wasn't something that you were necessarily happy to accept?
Well, for a long time I did accept it, and for a number of years I went from not believing to actually coming back and believing again and thinking, I do feel I've got some connection with, say, Jesus or a supernatural idea. Mm-hmm. But I think I believed it in a cultural way rather than actually believed it. I didn't believe it in any philosophical way, because those ideas still kept moving in my head, and they have not been resolved to the idea of believing in a supernatural deity, and I cannot believe that, you know.
Okay, well, we'll come to some of your questions, which are, of course, the kind of questions that Josh deals with on an almost daily basis in many ways. Let's introduce now Josh McDowell, who, as I say, has for some time been at the forefront of apologetics work, especially in the USA, but well-known to many here in the UK as well. Just before we say hello, let's hear Josh in action, speaking to students about why we can really believe Jesus died before he rose again. This is an extract from his regular podcast. Let's take a listen.
Then it says that they did not break the legs of Jesus. Now, why would they break the legs if they had decided to? And often they did break the legs. And the reason is, when they wanted to bring about death faster, they would break a person's legs, actually their shins. Now, why would they do that? Well, most crosses had a little seat called a sedecula. And this little seat, the person could sit on portionally. And the way they would survive when they were being crucified for a while is that they would push up and they would let the air out. And then when they sat back down or went down, they would take air in. And this was a problem. If they could not straighten their legs out, the pectoral muscles affected their breathing, and the way you would often die from crucifixion, you would die from your own air. You could not exhale the air because you're a pectoral muscles. So they would push up, they could exhale, and then they'd take air in and go down. So when they wanted to bring about death early, they would break their legs where they couldn't push up. And then the person died of their own air. And yet, Jesus, because of the whipping and what he had gone through, was already dead. So they didn't need to break his legs. And this is interesting, because the Old Testament prophecy was, not a bone in his body would be broken. And so if Christ hadn't been dead at that time, they would have broken the shin bones so he would die of his own air. And then there were four executioners. You say, what? That's right. There wasn't just one. The Romans had four different executioners and why. Each one of these executioners had to sign the death warrant. Each one of them, all four, had to examine the body to make sure that that body, that that person was dead. And then they would all sign them. Because if the person was taken down and wasn't dead, then the very Roman guard and executioners were punished by the Romans. And so when they did take Christ down from the cross, they knew he was dead. Four executioners had signed his death warrant. In the next session, I want to start out by describing what the tomb looked like and then what happened after he was buried and see some of the theories that try to explain away the resurrection. But one thing is for sure historically. On the third day, the tomb was empty. And as one of the hymns say, he is risen, he is risen. He is risen indeed.
Knowing that Jesus died for our sins is amazing, but also knowing that he rose from the dead after he was crucified is incredible. It is important to know about how Jesus died so that we can understand the sacrifice that God was willing to make in order to save us. Next week, Josh will continue his talk about the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. This podcast was brought to you by Josh McDowell Ministries. To learn more, please visit www.josh.org.
Welcome along to the program, Josh. Great to have you with us.
Hey, well, thank you.
I've wanted to get you on this program for a while, and so when I heard you were coming to the UK, I thought, hey, here's my chance. Grab Josh and have him on, and thank you for agreeing to do that. But you've got a very interesting story yourself, Josh, of how you did come to faith. Just give us the background to that.
Well, I really agree with Karen a lot, is that one of my biggest absolute gripes with Christians, they know what they believe, and they have no idea why they believe it. I think that's about the stupidest thing in the world. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
Because the scripture is very clear. Be ready to give an answer for the hope that is in you. And what that means is somebody says, why do you believe in Christ as Son of God? Well, be able to give an answer, not your belief. Give an answer. Why do you believe Christ was raised from the dead, etc.? And I was not an atheist. I was an agnostic and kind of an obnoxious. You have an ordinary agnostic and an obnoxious agnostic. And I think I was obnoxious. Because I just didn't like Christians, I didn't like the church, the Bible, or anything until I was challenged by some professors in university and some students to examine it intellectually, which I really thought was a joke because I believe Christians had two brains. One was lost and it was all looking for. I mean, I really did. And so they so irritated me, I set out to write my first book against Christianity. And in the process, I came to London to do some of the research, and I was in northeast London, the small museum library. And I leaned back in my chair. It was a Friday night about 6:30, and against totally everything I wanted to believe, I finally said, it's true. It's true. It's true. And that was a reference to the New Testament. Not that it was the Word of God. I wasn't even near that position. But I concluded as an obnoxious university student that I could hold the New Testament in my hand and say what I have today is what was written down. It has not been changed. And second, what was written down was true, only true in the sense that true that Jesus said this. I hadn't concluded that what Jesus said was true. It was true that he said it and true that he did it. And then my attitude changed from being antagonistic to attacking it to I feel I became an honest inquirer.
Okay.
I think very similar to Karen here. Yeah. And I just came to different conclusions with that. And finally, I was confronted and found out it took more faith not to believe.
And from that, you really have launched yourself into a path which has been all about showing others that if you, in your opinion, do make an honest inquiry, you can find facts which point to a verdict, which is, you know, that Christ did rise from the dead. Christ was the Son of God. And that's obviously been something that's been the forefront of your life since then.
That's right.
Well, we're talking this afternoon with Josh McDowell, well known in the evangelical Christian world for his apologetics work, but also Kieran O'Pronte, who's joining us from Derry in Northern Ireland. And we're going to be addressing now some of Kieran's own questions about faith and belief, and because there are all kinds of reasons, I think, why different people, you know, find that they have trouble believing. And when I say have trouble believing, that many people would say it's imperative on the Christian to show a good reason for believing in the first place, you know. So Kieran, just let's go back to some of those sort of reasons why, you know, you obviously had a sort of some element of Christian upbringing,
yes.
but you never felt like it was ever really put in a way that was convincing to you?
Well, I think I felt it in my heart, but my head kept reserving its judgment for a long time. And once I engaged both of them together, that was whenever I was able to sort of have the confidence, perhaps, to say, well, I don't have to believe this. It's not like a crutch I need anymore. It's not something which does make sense to me. And if I do look at it in the cold light of day, that it is not true, you know.
What bits of it then weren't making sense to you?
Well, basically, the only bit but is actually the hinge, I believe, of what Christianity has to be is the idea of a supernatural being. I can believe that there was a Jesus and that he was an extraordinary man, that I can't say he rose from the dead, which would be supernatural, but I do believe that he had a great impact and a very positive impact on lots of people and the whole world. But for somebody to say then that this was this shows that there is sort of an omnipotent type of supernatural being which can look down and
so
get involved in
that sense. On your reading of the New Testament, you can obviously see the value in the sayings of Jesus,
yes,
and those sorts of things. But those perhaps bits of the Gospels which claim deity and supernatural events, for you, you'd need more than just the Gospel.
Well, obviously, at some point, to the supernatural, I don't think, can ever be proved. I don't think it can be proved because it doesn't exist, in my mind. But I don't think even sometimes Christians want to say it can be proved because it would sort of do away with the idea of what supernatural really is. So there is an element where things have to be taken on trust at least some point.
I just did not decide
to give that trust.
Okay, well, before we press on with this debate, let me remind you, if you're listening, that you can get in contact with us if you want to respond to anything you hear on the programme today, be it comments from Kieran or indeed from Josh. And the way to do that is via telephone or email. Now, you can get in touch by telephone. You can leave a voicemail message for us on Premier Response's number. That's 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. Alternatively, you can email us. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. So once again, if you want to respond to anything you're hearing, perhaps it's the comments that Kieran has been making in this half of the programme, 08456 52 52 52, select option 5, or email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, time to return to our debate with Josh McDowell, a US apologist, and indeed Kieran O'Pronte, who is our sceptic on the programme today. And Kieran, before we went to the break, was just suggesting that we can't actually prove God. Let's bring in Josh on this first question then. You know, can the supernatural be proved as far as you're concerned, Josh? Is there anything we can do to really prove that God exists? Does that do away with the whole point of faith if we could prove it?
I think what Karen is asking here is coming back to the person of Jesus Christ. A lot of people argue from God to Christ. I say, no, I had to start with Christ who I could get my hands on. He lived a time point history and go from Christ to God. And one of the things Karen said here is that, you know, Christ was a good man. He did a lot of great things, some great teachings and everything else. But here's the problem with that, Karen. I really struggle with that as a non-believer in this sense. I could not call Christ a good man, his teachings good, if his teachings were false. And what I was confronted with over and over again, Jesus was different than other religious leaders. Other religious leaders put their teachings out in front and themselves in the background. Jesus did the opposite. He put himself out in front. Others would say, well, how are you related to what I teach? Jesus said, how are you related to me? And what I ended up with, I was confronted with a person who literally claimed to be God Yahweh, a creator God in human flesh. He made those claims over and over. That's what got him crucified. over and over and over again. Like the trial of Jesus, most people, Karen, are tried for what they did. Jesus was tried for who he was.
Well, you could say perhaps he was tried for the potential he had, which in itself was a threat at the time.
Well, yes, there was the political, there was the economic. He was throwing all the money changers out of the temple. He was upsetting the political thing. But all that was based upon his claims to being God himself. And here was what I struggle with. C.S. Lewis, this was an issue with C.S. Lewis from Cambridge. The claims that he made about himself, if they were not true, then I could not call him a good teacher because he was teaching falsehood.
Was it not summed up by C.S. Lewis? I'm trying to remember the phrase now, but God is either, Jesus was either a good, Jesus was either God or a liar or a madman. He can't be
no.
a mishmash of all three.
I think C.S. Lewis, and I think he had an influence in me coming down to this called the trilemma. He was either a lord, a liar, or a lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
I do not believe Jesus ever left the option open to call him a good man, a mere good man. Because a good man wouldn't make the claims about himself being God in human flesh. So then I had to ask, could I call him a liar? No. If he was a liar, then a lie accomplished more good than the truth ever did. Was he a lunatic? If he was a lunatic, what about the rest of us? But I didn't want to call him Lord. I did not want to call him Lord. That's when I had to examine the evidence. Is there evidence historically to support his claims?
What do you make of this trilemma that Josh has just outlined,
well,
Kieran?
I can understand it as a precept for discussion, but I think it sort of closes down a number of avenues as well. There is the idea that somebody grown up in a culture time 2,000 years ago, like, there was nobody sort of saying that there was no such thing as some type of God or some type of supernatural being. It would be very hard for a person to be able to discuss ideas of morality and the idea of loving your neighbour and laying down your life for your friends in such a way and say that there was no such thing as a supernatural being. It would be very hard for anybody even to get the idea around their heads. So I think...
But Karen, it was Jesus himself that's saying he was a supernatural being. Not someone else,
but
Jesus
that was
himself.
Part of a... Well, I mean, there were other people who were putting forward similar type of ideas about different religious leaders.
Name one.
Well, I mean, I'm only going from a general reading of the time, and there were a number of people who claimed to be
who?
Things like besides, I don't have their names.
I don't know of any other. Boy, I've examined that period big.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was anyone other. That's why Jesus stood out.
Well, I mean, there have been throughout the course of history a number of people who have claimed that they have had some supernatural, they have been told by a supernatural being that they are the chosen person to bring human beings.
So you're saying what makes Jesus different to those people?
Karen, yes, you're right. Those are saying that some supernatural being sent him. Jesus said, I am God. See, that's a whole different ballgame, Karen.
Well, this is a question which also that, you know, like people who would say that God is within everyone, how does that square up? Could I not say, if I was a Christian, say that I am God, I'm a part of a God? Or
You can. Just because you claim something doesn't mean it's true. Uh-huh. I mean, there's a lot of people claiming everything out there. But the question is...
And that makes Jesus then a liar, if that was... But if that's what he believed, could that not be...
Not if he was deluded. I mean, come on. When you claim to be God in human flesh, he said, I and the Father are one. And boy, when he did that, he said, in essence and nature. And you say, well, that's just how you interpret it, how the Jews interpret it. They picked up stones to kill him because they said, you being a man, make yourself out to be divine, God.
Well, people with a pantheistic type of view would say that we are all God or we've all got a part of God. I mean,
Karen, here, yes, you can say all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But what does the evidence show up? Let's come back to Christ. This is where I struggled, Karen, mm-hmm. is that Jesus not only claimed to be God, he said there's evidence to show it. And there were two big pieces of evidence, not the only, but that stood out to me. One was prophecy fulfilled in his life. Karen, I didn't want to believe this, you have to understand. I wanted to refute it. I start examining the Old Testament, 333 prophecies, and I document all of them from Jewish sources that these are messianic prophecies. 333 written down over
that,
five...
Just on that specific point, is it not a case maybe of being correct after the matter?
I mean, so putting an interpretation of, on it afterwards.
Yeah, and he would have been obviously very knowledgeable of what these prophecies would have been, and...
When he made, well, he was very knowledgeable. That's why in Luke 24 he said, "Everything is written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms
it must be fulfilled." Like the chicken and the egg, though, in the sense.
So what you're suggesting, Kieran, is, for instance, I'm thinking of one prophecy in one of the Old Testament prophets talks about your king coming on a donkey, and of course Jesus fulfilled that prophecy by riding on a donkey into Jerusalem before he was crucified. Now, Kieran, is the point you're making, well, Jesus knew the prophecy, so yes, he did the thing to fulfill it, and that's not really fulfilling prophecy.
No, that's exactly my point is.
Okay. Well, there's a handful of those that could take place, but with 333, where, like, he'd be of a virgin birth, a very unusual birth, the lineage of Shem, the descendants of Abraham, he'd be of the line of Isaac, the line of Jacob, he'd be of the tribe of Judah, he'd be of the family of Jesse, he'd be of the house of David. He would be crucified, and the way they described the crucifixion in Psalm 22, that method of crucifixion was not put into 800 years later by the Roman legions.
But all of that still does not really prove that he was anything more than a liar at the same time. He may have just been deluded and accepted that, you know.
He could have, but even his delusion, he couldn't have worked out to fulfill the 333 prophecies. That's where finally they said, wait, something is unusual here. Especially it'd be more difficult for him to do it if he was deluded. He'd have to be more intelligent to try to pull that off. But just the probability, a Dr. Peter Stoner, a scientist, wrote a book on this called Science Speaks. And he used the modern science of probability to figure out the probability of only 8 of these prophecies, just 8, being fulfilled in any one individual, not just Christ, but any one individual, not 333 of them, just 8.
Yeah.
And he came out to 1 in every 1 times 10 to the 17th power. That's 1 in every quadrillion possibility.
Well, I haven't said that. That still does not in any way prove that, you know, that Jesus was God or was supernatural. Like, I mean, what your evidence is based on scriptures which have been written and rewritten, and
let's talk about that in the next break. Let's talk about that. Okay. That's where my heart is, Kieran.
Well, that's interesting because Kieran, your point there being, how can we trust these documents? You know,
yeah,
and they may have been revised by possibly church fathers wanting to put their own spin on things or whatever it may be. I mean, this is, again, one of Josh's passions. Well, we'll look at that in our next section because time is drawing to a close for this particular section of the programme. With me on the programme today, Josh McDowell. He's well known for his work in Christian apologetics. That's the idea of defending the Christian faith, perhaps best known for his best-selling book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And Josh has written in a number of other ways as well on similar topics. Well, we're talking about some of the claims that Christianity makes. It's what we do every week here on Unbelievable. And the person, if you like, putting the questions to Josh today is our guest Kieran O'Pronte, who joins us live from Derry in Northern Ireland. And Kieran, just putting forward some of these questions about, you know, how can we really believe what Jesus said about himself? Is there conclusive proof that Jesus was the Son of God? And from that, can we really conclude, you know, all the other things that Christians believe? We're going to be looking more at this discussion very soon. You're with Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio. Welcome back. Before we go back to our discussion with Josh McDowell and Kieran O'Pronte, let me tell you, next week is, of course, Pentecost. And because that's the theme of next week, we're going to be looking at the gift of tongues. That's what came with the gift of the Holy Spirit, of course, to the first Christian believers. But what do we think about the gift of tongues now? Well, we're going to be hearing from Gerald Coates. He's the director of the Pioneer Group of Churches. He's going to be talking about why he speaks regularly in tongues, why he believes it's an utterly profound way of communicating, if you like, with God. And we'll also be hearing from skeptic Stephen Pilcher, who says he believes it's all about suggestion. He doesn't believe in the gift of tongues. He's an agnostic, and he says, frankly, he's not convinced. We'll also be hearing other views. So that's the gift of tongues at this time next week here on Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back in the studio with me, Josh McDowell. Josh, very well known in the Christian world for his work in apologetics, also works in youth ministry, leadership issues, but here on Unbelievable, he's our guest as he explains why he believes there is good reason, in fact, a conclusive proof that Jesus was the Son of God and that God does exist, perhaps best known for Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Josh also has written a number of other books about Christian faith. One that we're looking at today, Answers to Tough Questions About the Christian Faith, available through Authentic Media. And that really encompasses a lot of what we're talking about today. How do we know that the scriptures are true? How can we say that Jesus was the Son of God? You know, what about other aspects of belief and faith? You know, people who don't ever hear about Jesus, that sort of thing. Answers some interesting questions there if you want to get your hands on a copy. But also joining us today is Kieran, who's joining us from Derry in Northern Ireland. He, if you like, is our protagonist today, putting his questions, his thoughts about faith to Josh, and we're just going to continue our conversation now as we pick up sort of where we left off previously. The issue of the documents we have, both Old and New Testament, Josh. Kieran, you were saying, you know, surely in all that time there are going to have been revisions. I mean, where does your belief come from on this, Kieran?
Taking that point, maybe teasing out a little bit more, a lot of people would put a lot of store, unfortunately, in things like the prophecies of Nostradamus, and would prove, in a sense, through their own interpretation, that these things were true after the event happened. Mm. We've also got, in Ireland, there has been St. Colm Kill's prophecies as well, which people would have you turned to whenever a big thing happened and says, oh, this has proved us right. My problem is that it just seems too easy a way to say that there is a God by saying this. And also, another point I think is very important is that if Josh is trying to say that in a certain scientific way, he was using numbers there a while back, that this can be proved, does he not leave himself open to the whole idea of if you're prepared to use scientific methods in one way, do you not have to keep using them all the time because you can't pick and choose?
First of all, I'm not using the scientific method. How would you define the scientific method, Karen?
Well, you'd quoted there a scientist who had, or a mathematician who had...
Using the science of probability.
Yeah, well, science, yes.
A probability. How do you define science? I mean, you know, we're talking about science. How do you define science?
Well, I wouldn't see science as something which has to either prove or disprove whether there is a God or not. But it's the only way we really have of being able to describe the world.
No, but how do you define science? You said scientific proof. What is scientific proof?
What do you see and what you can prove to yourself without seeing taking something on trust from somebody else?
Boy, would I disagree with you. Oh, my gosh, Karen, you and I would come from...
Okay.
Scientific proof, and check out any scientific book on this or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Science deals with that which can be repeated, observation made, data drawn, and hypothesis verified through repetition.
Mm-hmm.
That is very limited in life.
Certainly is, but
when it comes to, wait a minute, when it comes to the prophecies, whatever, you can't apply science to it. Why? You cannot repeat them in a controlled environment, observation made. That's where the other approach, people call the historical approach, I like to call it the evidential approach. That's where you weigh the evidence that there is no reasonable doubt to believe it.
That is, in a still a sense, a scientific approach, an idea of weighing evidence to...
Okay, well, maybe we're just differing on the semantics of the word here.
Well, I mean, if you want to say that's science, and I said, okay, then let me prove Christianity scientifically, just by weighing the evidence and making an intelligent decision.
But you've got a problem here, Kieran, by the sounds of it, with what Josh is doing here, saying, look, you've got 333 Old Testament prophecies, which appear to point towards Jesus as being the fulfillment of that. And you're saying, Kieran... Look, does that really, you know, saying, you know, using that approach really, because are you saying similar things could happen in other areas of the world where prophecies appear to have been fulfilled and we don't therefore go and say that's a divine thing?
And how, for example, suppose you were growing up in Central Europe at a time of great change, there was lots of millenarian type of people coming about saying we're about to save the world, you know. Some of them done very, very bad things. It's the idea of letting your your mind go and not and to take something on trust rather than actually trying to find out for yourself is where I have a problem.
Well, now with that, I would have a problem too, because you don't do it by blindfold.
What you're asking me to do, though, is to accept that these prophecies that had said this and this happened. The evidence for all of this is quite little, is it fair to ask
accept Jesus as who he said he was because the prophecies appear to have been fulfilled in him, or is there more to it than that?
Oh, that's just a little tiny part. But the statement you made earlier, and I've had people in debates all over the world make these statements, and I call them down on it, Karen, and not one of them has ever been specific and documented, and I say, okay, give me another prophecy. You know why I say that? Finally, this publishing company in Denver, Colorado, got tired of all these people making these statements. Well, there were these prophecies and Nostradamus and all this. They offered a $10,000 reward for 30 years to anyone who could show any prophecy and just prove it was written down before the fulfillment and fulfilled afterwards, and not one person in 30 years could come up with a prophecy.
Do we not depend, in a sense, on the same people or the people that followed them that wrote about the prophecies as being fulfilled as the people that wrote the prophecies?
So what you're saying is that the New Testament writers, wanting to support their case, would have seen the Old Testament prophecies and kind of maybe rejiggled their stories a bit to make them fit with them. Is that what you're getting at?
Because I can't prove it is proved that this is what happened, I don't think anybody claims that the Bible, I don't think you do, Joyce, is a specifically historical piece of work. It is rather a religiously true piece of work.
Oh, I would disagree with you.
Right.
I will disagree with you.
So what you're saying is that the Bible is a true historical and can be used as a historical source?
Let's look at the New Testament, because we're only living it in time here, about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Karen, let's look at the New Testament. Absolutely, I'll say it's a historical document. This is where so many people are blind or ignorant when it comes to this area and making all kinds of statements, just in the book of Acts and the book of Luke. Now think of this. 482 historical documentations verified in history, not one single statement false in Luke and Acts. That is absolutely unbelievable.
Just to explain what you mean by that, because I'm not sure I understood fully. So,
for example,
lots of these things documented outside the writing? Or?
That, for example, in Acts, he refers to my mind went blank. It was a title for political leaders.
Okay.
Everyone said it was wrong. Mm-hmm. Everyone said it was wrong.
That wouldn't have been the right title for the
That's
time
right,
he was
because
writing.
At that time, there was no other writings, anything that ever used that title and said it's a misrepresentation. Well, then they have found 19 inscriptions now with that title used on it. Six of them directly referenced to Thessalonica, as in the book of Acts.
But that only proves that it was probably written at the correct time.
It just shows it is an historical book.
Well,
that's the
point.
Would you
claim that the Bible can be used? And I mean, there are internal, at least slight internal inconsistencies with that. About say for the
okay, Karen. Let's have a little quiz here now.
Oh, no point in quizzing
with the New Testament. What? Okay, we'll talk the New Testament. Is historically accurate? Is it authentic and reliable? What tests would you apply? What are the principles that you apply as a non-believer to say that any piece of literature is not true? What would it be?
Well, I think whenever you read any piece of thing that's written down, and I know it from living in Ireland, for example, there was Bloody Sunday in Derry, and the government, the British government, had an inquiry, and this was given as official facts. These people believe these were the official facts, but if you lived in there, you knew they weren't official facts.
How do you check them out? How do you know whether they're official or not, accurate or not?
Well, I know from people who were there at the time that they were not true. Like, I mean, that's only one way, but I wasn't there, but I know that.
So what you're saying is what gets written down doesn't always cohere with what actually happened.
Okay, Karen, with any document of history, apply what's called an historiography.
Yep.
An historiography is simply the test to check out the authenticity and reliability of a document, whether the Bible or what, it doesn't matter, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with any historiography, there's three main tests. One is the bibliographical test about the manuscripts, the internal evidence test of internal consistency, the external evidence test, are there other documents apart from the document you're examining that confirms the inner testimony? Just look at the bibliographical test. The bibliographical test asks questions of the manuscripts. A manuscript, by definition, is a handwritten copy over against a printed copy. The reason is, Literature of Antiquity was written on material that would perish. It was written on papyrus, and the ink would fade. They didn't have Parker Brothers then. Manuscripts. There's two questions they ask the manuscripts. One, how many manuscripts do you have? You see, Karen, the principle is the more manuscripts you have, the easier it is to reconstruct the original, check out any errors or discrepancies. Just with the New Testament, and I've documented this completely, I'm able to document 24,633 manuscripts of just the New Testament, the number two book in all history. And in manuscript authorities, the Iliad by Homer was 643 manuscripts.
What period does that cover? From when?
It covers from right about 120 A.D. Now, I would take the original writings back to 70. I think I can show that all four Gospels were written before 70 A.D. But it goes from about 100-110 A.D. right up until 1550 with the introduction of the movable type printing press.
But I mean, the point is that Christianity spread throughout Europe and other parts, and manuscripts was part of how people put forward information.
That's right. And because it gave us documentation.
Yeah, but that to me does not really prove that.
No, yes, it. Hey, Karen, come on now. You made a statement earlier that it's been changed and everything down through the years. Look, I can reproduce the New Testament to a 99.5% pure text. People tell me that, well, like the Muslim would say, the Christians came along and added to and everything. I said, oh, when they do that, 600 A.D.
Sorry,
I said, what are you talking about?
I should maybe rephrase what I was meaning. It was a question of interpretation of how these things were put down.
Now that's different. Now that's an honest question.
Let's just get from you, Kieran, what then your problem is. Because if it's not, in a sense, you know, whether these things have been accurately handed down over the years, but it's more a question of what was the intention of the original writers? Is that what I'm getting from you? Was their intention to accurately record history, or was it to pass a religious message, which isn't necessarily historical?
That plus an earlier point I was making, that what you have here is what they believe to be true, what they believe. Don't forget, up until about 100 years ago, 99% of the population of the world were very... they believed in superstitions and things like that.
You say 99% of the world. I call you on that statistic.
Well, up until, say, 100 years ago, maybe 200 years ago, it doesn't really matter. But
I don't think there was ever a period of time in all history. I've studied history by detail, and I've never known a period where 99% of the people believed in superstitions.
A large percentage of the population, not even maybe the majority.
But you're saying people have been more open to being, you know...
Rationalism, the idea that, you know... If you can't prove something, you know, that it's very hard to just believe it, or if you can't say that I've got some proof for it, it's very hard to believe it.
So from this point, are you saying then that there's a possibility that under that sort of idea that people were more open to being swayed by, you know, things that they couldn't explain, but maybe science and rational minds have now been able to explain, means that these New Testament writers were putting a slant on it which wasn't actually there, possibly?
Well, it was for them it was the truth. I mean, it was in their culture that was perfectly true, you know. But I think if you look at it in the 21st century, perhaps some of the things which are described will be described differently today.
Okay, well, let's see what Josh has.
Well, boy, first of all, I will go back there. Yes, that's what they believed to be true. And they paid their price in blood for it. They became martyrs for what they believe. Now, the extremity...
The extremity
of your sacrifice has nothing to do with the truth of what you died for. But it just means that they believed that Jesus Christ was, on the third day, raised from the dead. That first, the tomb was empty. The grave clothes were still in there. The stone moved away. But that's not what convinced them. What convinced them was, because there's many explanations for an empty tomb, natural and supernatural, and I outline that in my books. Mm-hmm. What convinced them were the appearances of Christ over a period of 40 days. He appeared to them. And here was Paul, who was a great Jewish leader who became a believer. He put his entire reputation in line. He said, look, he appeared over 500 people at one time. And this is where he put it on the line. He said, the majority of them are alive right now.
Why can I, if I can just step in for Kieran here, what is there a possibility, Josh, that whoever wrote those manuscripts, which put this claim that Jesus appeared to so many people, was doing it to present a case, was maybe embellishing things, was wanting to show Jesus in a certain light?
No, absolutely not. Yes, they were presenting a case, but here's the problem. There were people alive at that time who knew what Jesus said, knew what Jesus did. They were aware of the issues. The greatest defender of the truth, Justin, was the New Testament community, not the church. The secular community around the church was the greatest defender of truth because they did not dare to add to or take away what Jesus said or did. And this is where you got to realize, they not only wrote as eyewitnesses, and a lot of people miss that historically, but they appealed, and this is key. When I study history and go into a debate, this is key. They appealed to the knowledge of their readers and listeners concerning what they talk about. They not only said, look, we saw this, but in the presence of knowledgeable, hostile Jewish people that didn't want to believe, they said, you did too. You were there. You saw Jesus do that. You heard Jesus do that. And historically, to me, that's probably the best confirmation of evidence. I call it a positive reference from a hostile source that didn't want to believe.
Okay, could I take that on a wee bit then from then? Taking it as read now that you have had some way of, to yourself, proven, and perhaps proven to other people, that Jesus was the Christ and that he did what he said he did. Would you not feel then that, or do you think that it can be proved in another way, for example, in a physical way? And why, if not, why not? I mean, if it is so true that it is something which is provable.
Wait, let me correct something here, Karen. Correct something that Justin did in the introduction, and I'm not sure who wrote that, said that Josh McDowell's book has conclusive proof.
Okay.
That is absolutely true.
Okay.
You have beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. And it comes to, Karen, it comes to faith. But here the thing is, the Christian faith is an intelligent faith. It is not a blind faith. Christian faith goes with the evidence, not contrary to it. And this is why I believe you lay out the facts, you let people look at it, you have the ultimate decision. It's individual with a person. But my faith is not a blind faith. I know why I trust the New Testament. I mean, look, there's not only 24,000 documents different between the New Testament and any other book in history. That's why you can reproduce it in the New Testament. Nobody can tell me, well, it's been changed down through the years. Second, just time-wise, the closest of any other, the great books of history, anything else, is 400 to 600 years minimum, usually 1,500 years, the closest manuscript after it was written. With the New Testament, it goes back within 50 to 60 years.
Sorry, I just didn't get that point there.
Well, the point is that, see, you would have an original manuscript called the autograph, the autographa, autographa, and that would start to rot away, Karen. So you would copy generation number one, maybe 200-300 copies, but then that would start to rot away generation number 2-3. The question is, historically, is how close the copy you have, how far is it removed from the original? Because history shows the further it is removed, the greater chance of error and discrepancy. Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to the timeline,
was that it was the people who had says that prophecy has been fulfilled is the ones that wrote it.
No, it isn't. Well, no, it isn't. Okay. The prophecies were written in the Old Testament, 1,000, some of them 1,500 years
that,
before.
But I mean, these were people who were coming out of the same culture and would have known and probably felt that these prophecies were true.
Well, yes, they did. But here's the thing: they were open to refutation. See, that's one nice thing about Christianity. If it's not true, it is open to refutation. For example, in every debate I say to people, Karen, you prove to me that Jesus Christ was not raised from the dead on the third day and my entire faith crumbles. Not one person in 46 years of debates.
Equally, you have not been able to prove that he has.
Like, well, no, but I believe you can give the most phenomenal historical evidence that on the third day the tomb was empty, and second, he appeared over 15 different times and once to 500 people, and that their lives were changed and they died for it.
But if you do believe that, you must be able to say that there are other ways that you could prove that the evidence of a supernatural being...
Well, how? There's only basically the evidential way. Well, you could do the philosophical. You could reason philosophically, but you come to, I think, to a blind alley philosophically.
But what you are basing the whole thing on is the veracity and the importance of the New Testament.
Yes, you're right. You're right, Kieran. You got me in the corner.
Let's tackle this, okay? Because, Kieran, you're saying, okay, granted, you may be able to get to a point where you can say what we have now is 99.5%, as you were saying, Josh, the same as what was written originally. Now, the question is, the things that were written originally, was it someone making it up? Were they doing it for their own benefit? And that, I think, is your point, Kieran.
It is, yes.
Yeah.
No, I would say one. No, because they wrote as eyewitnesses, and they appealed to their readers and listeners concerning the facts they spoke of. See, this is what's unique about the resurrection. If the resurrection didn't happen, Karen, the most difficult place in all the world to prove it to anyone would have been Jerusalem. Where did the apostles go? They go off to Athens or Ephesus or Thessalonica or Galatia? No, they went right back to the city of Jerusalem. If what they were preaching was false, could have been falsified by a 15-minute walk by any critic. It was open to falsification. And this is why so many, even of the Jewish religious leaders, became believers, because on the third day, he was raised from the dead.
Well, I mean, you weren't there. I wasn't there. What you have built up is quite a good body of...
Well, you weren't at 9/11. So, you weren't at 9/11. I was at 9/11. Who say it didn't happen then, Karen? Come on.
No. I was actually going to make a point. It was probably for you there, but the point still remains that you have to view all these things through the cultural eyes of what the people were at the time like. And I don't think that we can actually say that the people at the time didn't believe. These people weren't, in a sense, people who were able to say there is no such thing as God. They actually believed, it was part of their total belief, that there was a God of some form. So the idea of someone...
For some, yes, and for some, no. Not much different than today.
Well, I don't know. Well, I mean, I haven't studied enough to know...
They sure didn't believe in the resurrection.
Well, they believed in supernatural ideas. That would mean that the resurrection would fit quite well and easily within their terms of reference.
No, it didn't. Karen, that's an historical blunder. Resurrection did not fit into their worldview.
That's why it was so hard for them to believe. No, you can make a different point of saying that the idea of resurrection might have been outside of their terms of reference. My point is that their terms of reference would have included supernatural events, and that would be termed a supernatural event.
So you're saying they didn't have a problem, obviously, believing in God. That was the culture that they existed on, whereas, obviously, today's culture, you have to address that question too. But you're saying because of that, pre-existent belief in God, they were more likely to be convinced by arguments, someone saying, oh, so-and-so is raised from the dead.
Well, I sure came from the opposite way.
I came
from the belief there was no God or anything else.
No, but you see, we're talking now in the 21st century, and we can discuss those things. That type of debate was never going on in those days.
What kind of debate wasn't going on?
The idea of the existence of a supernatural being. Like.
There absolutely was a debate going on. Read all the writings around the New Testament. Tacitus, Josephus, all of them.
What were they saying then?
Well, they were saying then they questioned even the existence of God. Even the Greeks had no concept of really the supernatural. It was more mythological. And that was a big division between Christianity and Greek mythology.
But the mythology was how they came to be. It was still pointing, not in any way sort of saying that there was no such thing as a god, the deus ex machina type of thing, that could come in and change the normal people's lives. Like, they did believe that could happen.
Let me sum it up. We're over. You made a statement in the first session that Christianity was a crutch. I admit it is a crutch for me. It is. And I look at it this way. If Jesus Christ is who he claimed to be, and he was raised from the dead on the third day, and because he was not only man, but he was God, and he went to the cross, and he took my sins upon himself and paid the price for it, though I might be forgiven, then for me to say that Jesus Christ is my crutch would be like a light bulb saying to a socket, "You're my crutch." A light bulb was created to function completely in the context of a socket. I believe I was created by a personal creator God to function in a relationship with him. In Exodus 34:14, oh, this is mind-boggling. God said, "You shall worship no other God but the Lord, for I am a God who is passionate about my relationship
George,
with you."
So in that sense,
Christ is a crutch. He died for my sins.
I accept that that's what you believe, but you have to also believe that another person can say that I was created by whatever way I was created, and I was given a mind. It's up to me to use that mind. And if I don't use that mind, if there is or there's not a God, that God will still badly judge me if I don't use what has been given to me.
We're moving into a whole separate discussion.
But you're right.
Here, but
you have the responsibility for your life, Karen. I have the responsibility for mine. And part of my responsibility of knowing Jesus Christ personally as my Savior and Lord is to share that with others. What they do with it, it's not my responsibility. Their accepting or rejecting has nothing to do with my accepting them as a person. Whether a person is a Christian or not, I believe they're created in the image of God with infinite value, dignity, and worth. And I'm to treat every person that way.
Well, I would agree with you in that.
Kieran, it's been
fascinating. God, that we're all created in the image of God. We agree on that, Kieran.
Well, as you see,
I know
God
what
is.
You mean.
Kieran, thank you very much for contributing, and it's been really interesting. Obviously, we're never going to arrive at conclusive agreements within a short space of time, but I think it's brought out some interesting aspects, about, can we trust the text? And if we can trust the text, did the people really, mean what they said when they first wrote them and that sort of thing? But thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, both. Kieran, bless you. All that remains for me to say is thanks very much to Josh McDowell. If you want to find out more about Josh's writings, his books, etc., then the best way to do that in the UK is go to authenticmedia.co.uk. That's authenticmedia.co.uk. You're unbelievable. Join me next week as we look at the gift of tongues. It's, of course, Pentecost coming up, and that was when the disciples were given the gift of other tongues, the speech of other languages. But what about the gift of tongues today in the Christian church? We're going to be looking at different perspectives, including one skeptic, Stephen Pilcher, who says he simply doesn't believe it's really happening. We're going to be hearing also from Gerald Coates of the Pioneer Trust, the group of churches, and he's going to be telling me why he speaks in tongues, what he believes is happening when he does that. Do join me at the same time next week here on Unbelievable, 2:30 to 4 o'clock, and listen online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can listen to today's programme and many past programmes there. Do hope you enjoyed the programme today. See you next week.